You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you. So my name is Martin Rowe, and I've been interfering with this festival for a long, long time. And a couple of years ago, I was among a group of people invited to a meeting convened in London by the music producer Brian Eno. And if some of you don't have the app, so you're working with the paper programme, and you think Brian Eno's here, he's not. At the 11th hour, Brian couldn't come. He will be contributing, but I'll explain more in a moment. So on this day, about 2 years ago, a bunch of people, writers, activists, filmmakers, turned up at his studio in West London, and there were two kind of drivers. One of the drivers was a sense that we were living in a climate emergency, but the stories we were telling about this weren't very compelling. Most people didn't really get that this was a sense, well, the emergency. They didn't feel the emergency. And there was a sense that maybe artists need to get more involved in this. And then the second driver was a sense that there's a feeling of a democratic deficit, that people were feeling that decisions were being made without them. They were being marginalized and didn't have a say in their future. So this, it was a bit abstract. But on that first day, around about 50 people there, there was no particular, there wasn't any religious qualification. My guess is most of the people in the room didn't have a kind of current religious preoccupation or interest or practice. But when we came to conclude in the conversation for the afternoon, these were some of the themes that emerged. One was a feeling that we were missing a sense of ritual and we needed new rituals. Another was a sense people felt they lacked community. They were living in isolated lives and wanted to be part of communities. Another was something about the richness of communal singing. People missed it. And a fourth was a need for a new kind of language of the sacred. And all of these things at different times have been emblematic of good religion. And the people in this room were saying, kind of, we'd like a bit more of that, please. So Brian Eno, some of you will know, describes himself as an atheist, but he's also a believer in religion. He thinks we need religion. And many people who recognize we live in a climate emergency think there's a direct connection that we live in a kind of spiritual emergency, that the climate crisis is a spiritual crisis. So this session, I think, is one of the things that has emerged from that. And one of the leaders of this group, this collective, in which meets regularly now is Liz Slade, who is a Unitarian. And Liz is going to host this session with some other contributors who she'll introduce. And the idea is that we begin to ask ourselves what kind of religion would work if we had one. I mean, many of you no doubt have experienced good religion and bad religion. Many of you have been part of religion when it works. And many of you, I'm guessing, have walked away from it because it became kind of redundant, and it wasn't resonant any longer. So Brian has sent an audio recording with where he's coming from on this, and the idea is that these guys are going to offer their comments, and we'll hear from Brian, and then we'd like you guys, in just for 7 or 8 minutes, in small groups, to have a conversation about the kind of religion you long for, the kind of religion you'd like to see emerge in the future. And the big idea is that we'll kind of use this as a kind of laboratory, and maybe we'll practice this new religion at Greenbelt next year. We'll see. So for now then, there's one other thing. Our friend John over here is going to be capturing the conversation this evening on that board, and that board will remain up long after this session is concluded, and you can add to it. So I'd like to hand over to Liz now. Liz.
Thank you very much, Martin. So I'm going to reflect a bit of my experience and why I think this conversation is important. And then I'm going to invite Gail Bradbrook, one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, to share her perspective, and David Benjamin Blower, a writer and musician, theologian, to share his perspective as well. And then, as Martin said, we're going to invite you into the conversation. It's definitely a collaborative effort, because one thing we know is that no one of us has all of the answers. So my day job is being chief officer of the Unitarian movement in the UK. Most places I go to, people have never heard of Unitarianism. I suspect that the Greenbelt audience might be a little bit different. Some people describe us as Quakers with hymns. But what's really at the core of Unitarianism is a commitment to freedom and inquiry in religious practice. So I first stepped through the doors of a Unitarian church about a dozen years ago because I saw that the minister there used to be a scientist and he was an atheist. And I'd grown up in a Christian family, but when I was a teenager, it slowly, invisibly stopped being relevant to me. And then when I went on to study science at university and on to a career in the medical field, it just felt like I'd taken a different path and was no longer connected to religion. It wasn't part of my life. But then in my early 30s, I had that feeling of something being missing. And I remember thinking, oh, if only it could be religion, but I don't do that. And so discovering that there was a church led by an atheist scientist, it felt like safe territory. And as I kept going to this congregation, doors slowly started opening in my life that I hadn't known were there. I hadn't known that I could have a spiritual life. I hadn't known what it would feel like to be part of a community that really accepted me as me and wanted me to be more of myself. I didn't know what it felt like to be in mutual holding with each other when terrible things happened in the world or in our lives. And I sort of had a hunch that there might be wisdom somewhere in some ancient texts, but I had no idea that there, no expectation that there would be anything useful in the Bible for these times. But all of those things slowly changed, and church and spiritual community slowly became a bigger and bigger part of my being. And I tell this story because the things that kept me out of belonging to a faith community were not the things that I now know as being at the core of religion. So the things that kept me out were the sense that it was all oriented around this old man in the sky with a beard who had these powers that I just couldn't believe in. And I assumed that others thought that he had those powers and it just didn't make sense to me. And I had the idea that church was where you went to be told what to do or to be made to feel bad about yourself. And I just didn't need any more of that. And I had a sense that church was about conformity and keeping oneself under wraps. And I thought the songs were What I didn't know is that none of those things are what religion is really all about. But among who I call my normal friends, as in people who don't hang around places like this, they do still carry those ideas about religion. And they're interested that it's become such a big part of my world, but it hasn't shaken their shaping in a very secular world, and their engagement with religion doesn't go beyond organising their kids' outfits for the nativity play. But I've noticed over the last few years that sometimes these normal friends come and have a quiet word with me and talk about how scary the world is now and how we're not doing enough about the climate, and that they thought maybe my church could do something about it, or maybe they should be meditating, or is there something spiritual that is part of this whole unexplainable position we're in? And did I have any pointers? Where should they start? One thing that I suspect may be dotted among some conversations here over the weekend is the fact that there seems to be a bit of a wave of people finding Christianity anew, and particularly the sort of epidemic of high cultural capital, middle-aged, mainly bearded men who have unexpectedly embraced Christianity. And there's lots that's really interesting and wonderful about that. I loved hearing Martin Shaw here last year, and I love some of Paul Kingsnorth's writing, and I've adored Nick Cave for years, but part of my heart sinks at a new narrative of religion that we're letting being shaped by the powerful men, just like all the centuries so far. So in this conversation about the religion of the future, I hope that we can lean in to hear the quiet voices among us and within us of the elements that might make up the religion that we each really long for. One of the jobs I did before working with the Unitarian movement was to be COO of Sunday Assembly, which is a global network of secular congregations that was started by two stand-up comedians in London, where the community sing pop songs instead of hymns and listen to poetry and inspiring talks and testimony from community members. One thing I learned from that work at Sunday Assembly was just how hungry people are for meaning and belonging and are not looking for it in churches or, you know, other normal places of worship. And even though Sunday Assembly grew much more quickly than it had roots for and did everything on half a shoestring, it had the power to change people's lives. And the Instagram-friendly bunting and the power ballads meant that it was accessible in a way that dusty hymn books and pews and men in unexplained robes are not. But working there also showed me how important it is that the work of church-making is well-rooted. Although those of us who worked there really cared about each other, we also drank far too much coffee in the day and too much beer at night and worked with that sense of desperate activity that many well-meaning startups have. And it wasn't sustainable for me or for many of us. So I know that the religion of the future, if it's to be sustainable, needs to work with the flow of our beings. And that means all of our beings. It's 120 years since there was first a female Unitarian minister in Britain, Gertrude von Petzold. And it's only been 30 years since women were ordained in the Anglican Church. And neither of those moves has cleansed those churches of patriarchal misogyny. It's 47 years since the Unitarian Church affirmed the equality of lesbian and gay ministers. And it's 2 years since we affirmed the rights of trans people. And there's still so much work to do. I'm losing faith that institutions are good at changing themselves, which is a funny position to be in when you're leading an organisation. As a colleague said to me recently, I don't think any religious institutions have ever organised themselves into rejuvenation. And I realised early on in this role that my work was not to come up with a clever plan to reinvigorate the Unitarian movement. My work is to listen and to pay attention to which embers to blow on, which patches of soil to tend, which parts of the infrastructure are able to serve the future and which can gently decay into compost. And more I realise that the places to pay attention to are on the edges. And this might be true of other institutions as well. So Martin talked about our work as the Hard Art Collective. And our work there is in the knowledge that, yes, we definitely need governments to make tough decisions, but it's culture that influences people's lives and their loves. And culture is really not just the global megastar on a stage. It's what we do in our neighbourhoods. It's what we all do. And so in pondering the religion of the future, I think about the Buckminster Fuller line that you've probably heard. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So that's the invitation for our exploration today. Not to spend more time than we need to naming the painful realities of religion today, but by imagining that new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Knowing that we can carry all we want of what is good now, and knowing that we can leave behind anything that weighs us down or gets in the way of what is sacred or life-giving for us. So we're going to invite you to explore this for yourselves, but first we're going to hear from a few more people who've been feeling into the future. So over to you, Gail.
Well, thank you. I have some thoughts to share, and they're thoughts, please, humility, who knows. The new religion is a deep reconnection with life, with the animist nature of reality in an organized, conscious, and liberatory way. It's not a belief, because in the ways that Ian McGilchrist has described, it's about where we pay attention. Part of that will be to recognize the anti-life programs of, whether we want to call it patriarchy or the domination paradigm or Wetiko, as I've talked about in previous spaces, to learn how to recognize the systems of oppression, of domination and control that we've been enculturated into. And as we recognize it, to seek to disavow those systems within us, around us, in our groups, and to disempower them, as in to literally take away their power in the ways that we are co-opted into serving a system, whether it's through what we pay for, what we agree to do with our labor in time, when we agree to serve a system, when we get co-opted into it, etc. And it needs hospicing at many different layers. And then we look to recognize life-affirming, heart-centered, regenerative ways and seek to contribute to a framework of ecology of needed activities at this time, whether it's healing the water, healing the land, the many, many, many activities that are needed. And also as part of that, a core element is the cultivation of what Oren Lyons talks about as being the collective good mind. How do we create wellness together? What activities, what rituals, what singing, what processes create wellness together? What enables us to be human beings together? And many cultures that are life-affirming and regenerative have figured that out. They come from the land that you live in, though. So whilst we may be gifted from indigenous practices, ways to learn and remember, what we're in is a time to remember what this land has to teach us, and it will come from the land. And I mean that very directly. The plants and the fungus are our teachers. As part of that, then we then contribute to the emergence at both a local to global level of an immune response. As a human species, we have an immune response to the anti-life systems, the systems of domination. When we see it in practice, we work as a collective to close it down. What might that look like? I think what's happening around Gaza, Palestine, Israel is an example of that. We will go after it with the insurance sector. We will look at what finances it. We will close things down. We will campaign. We'll lobby. We'll hold vigil in space. We'll pray. We will be a global immune response for a global problem. Is it a problem? It's a place where we lost trust in life. And foundationally, it has to be fun and juicy and joyful at its heart, because that is the nature of the life-affirming systems in our bodies. It's not an earnest practice of being right. It's a joyful dancing of life within us, and that's where the medicines of the land will support us. I have been autistically probably special interest in about Amanita muscaria mushrooms, for example, the red and white spotted mushrooms we're taught to hate and fear. And it turns out if you smoke them with a water pipe, it's like MDMA when you put some music on. It's joyful and you dance. And maybe that's what the people did that came before us. And that's maybe why we've been taught to hate them, and maybe why the Christians were made to burn the witches. Modern witches study chemistry, by the way, like me. And that mushroom has two forms. It has ibotenic acid and muscimol. It does some cool stuff. It's where the pixies are from in this land. It's why it's our Christmas mushroom. It's not the only thing that's out there to serve, but I will have a little with me on Sunday if you want to join me at 7. It is part of the flying ointment that the witch has put on broomsticks and inserted in there. What, Paul? Where did they put it?
That's in the vagina.
Yes. the witch has put it in their vagina, and that's where the flying comes from. So and that got you burned as a witch. So, like, let's remember what we have in this land, guys. Let's enjoy. So then I think, how will we organise this? Manda Scott, who's been working on Thrutopian novels, how do we get through these times together? In her Boudicca novels, dreamed in what probably happened in Celtic times. The elders, the grandmothers, they cared for the village. They helped cultivate the collective good mind. The dreamers and the healers, they fell into what it is to be done, and the warriors gave themselves fully to the needed battles. And the singers and the artists and the visionaries, they revealed the vision, they revealed our courage, they sang of our victories and our laments, and they helped to lift us up to do the work that needed to be done. And what is your role in those places? What are you going to be building? What is it then for an individual, you know, what's and within our groups, what's ours to do? I feel it in this way. It's first of all acknowledging the gifts that we bring, and it's to seek in prayer in this connection to the life intelligence. It exists. Like, if you go and connect, in my experience, it's real. It's not a belief system. Ask what's needed, ask for help, seek guidance, and then move forwards to stretch into the edge of your courage, as Charles Eisenstein said, and then to learn and to grow and to keep moving forward and to have faith in ourselves as a species, right? We're meant to be a keystone species. We're meant to make life more beautiful. That's what the indigenous folks do. They don't guard biodiversity. They create biodiversity because that's what we're here for. So let's remember and reconnect with life. And in that way, to finish, I imagine us taking ceremonies onto the streets where we remarry life and we say, yay, we're back with you, life. We're sorry we went off on a bit of a diversion, but in the meantime, we cooked up some cool tools, and now we're going to use that, like science, in service to the regeneration, to the healing, to the stopping of the harm. So let's believe in ourselves as a species, and let's really feel the life energy coming through us. Thank you. That's the new religion.
Thank you so much, Gail. David Benjamin Blower, over to you.
Grand. I wrote a poem to make sure that you wouldn't take it too seriously. Did it come as a surprise to wake up one morning and find that the world had become a religious place again? It was a matter of curiosity in some quarters of the pale-faced world, which once believed it had overcome such superstitions and lit the way into some new dawn of enlightenment. The world was religious again, but religious how? Religion, friends, is become strange again. It doesn't behave the way it used to, when we kept it in carefully labeled jars on shelves. It doesn't move the way it used to, when we drew up its boundaries and said this far and no further. Religion is strange again, and I don't think it will willingly return to the old enclosures. So I won't draw out those kinds of maps, but perhaps it would be good to notice some creaturely limitations around myself. First, I don't predict the future. I predict the present, said Marshall McLuhan. It'll be enough for me to experience and understand what is happening now in slow real time and not be captured by the reflux of the past. Second, neither is it for me to decide the religion of the future and manage it into existence. The people who believe that this is their task are the very people I distrust. All I can do is share with you my small longings, experiences, and desires. So third, finally, I cannot speak for anyone but myself, nor do I wish to decide upon the futures of others. Of greatest use In the pockets of my mind are these two things. The question that leans in and the silence in which another's story is heard. I want to relativize myself amidst you all, my relatives. I want to be small. I want to be a creature again. Perhaps it sounds rather ascetic or even self-diminishing, but let me tell you about my desire and my longing. Let me tell you about the eros that moves me. I am driven by awe. Power is boring. Control always leads me to the wrong kind of chaos. I will exchange them both for the joy of creaturely awe. I want to be small. I am one who prays lovingly to a creator, but I don't aspire to their seat, nor do I wish to be their keeper or manager. I don't believe they need looking after by me. I identify with the soil from which I came, with every cell and atom of this material creature. I receive this interdependence as gift and miracle, heavenly citizenship hid amid suffering in plain sight. I am a member of all things. I thrive when all things thrive, and I lose when all things loses. To be small is to be in awe and to be in love. And there is nothing so measureless as this, and there is nothing so diminishing as power and control. I want to be small. I'm not interested in the management of some linear story or in traditions that occupy themselves endlessly with the question of themselves. I am here for the tradition that is in love with everything else. A complex ecology of folklore and creaturely awe in smallness. I want to be small.
Thank you so much, David. That was beautiful. And as you know, Brian Eno couldn't be here in person, but he recorded a message for us, which I'm just going to unlock my phone so that we can play.
Although I grew up a Catholic and was educated at Catholic schools, I was happy to get out of those schools and to declare myself an atheist. In fact, I even went a bit further with it. I called myself an evangelical atheist, since I thought that one of the things I might do for the world was convince them that religion really wasn't very helpful. I continued like this pretty much into my 30s, I guess, something like that. And then there was a fly in the ointment, and that fly was gospel music. I started to think it was strange that I loved that music so much, and other kinds of religious music as well, and yet didn't have much respect for the tradition out of which those musics had been born. But I didn't let that bother me too much. But I noticed, particularly when I lived in America and I started visiting a few gospel churches, ostensibly to hear the music, I started noticing that I liked the society that religion had made in those places. So then I started saying that I didn't believe in God, but I do believe in religion. I believe that there is something in the fact of people getting together, being vulnerable with each other, being open with each other, sharing lots of things with each other, and showing interest in each other's lives that is really healthy. As I became more politically engaged in various things, I started to think that really the answer to the most of the serious problems we face in terms of governance and getting things changed in the right direction could be and had to be really solved by community. When we witness, as we do now, the very richest people being so much richer than anybody else, and realize that, of course, they can buy the kind of government that they want, which is what they've been doing, you think, well, there's the only response that we have, the rest of us, is each other. We can make communities that are stronger than their money. They've got the money, we've got the people. And this made me start looking at religion more closely, because religion, of course, has always been a process of building communities. Now, every Tuesday evening in my studio for the last 25 years or so, a group of us get together to sing. It's a group of varying size and various personnel, but there's a kind of level of love, I would say, between us, even though we come from very, very different backgrounds. And yet, this activity that we do every Tuesday evening brings us close together. The second idea is that religion is really a place where we are able to admit that we don't control everything, that we don't understand how everything works, and we can practice surrendering to that. We can allow that feeling to wash over us. It's a feeling that isn't common in technical cultures. We tend to think that because we can solve many problems technically, we can solve them all technically. That isn't the case. And we have to learn how to live with the fact that we don't know everything, that we are often ignorant and sometimes very wrong. And I think one of the aspects of religion I like is allowing people to admit that they exist in a state of uncertainty and not to be slaughtered by that fact. I don't know whether I need to believe in God for that to happen. I suppose what you need to believe in is in your ability to be much bigger and much smaller than you are at the moment. Much bigger in the sense that you belong to something huge. Much smaller in the sense that you don't take yourself so seriously as being such an important factor in the landscape. I know the word is hard to use and it's been used too much, but it is about love, and it's about the idea of living in love with who you are, where you come from, who you are with, and the world that you're part of. If religion is the celebration of that, then we should probably all be doing more of it.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, thank you to Brian and to our three other very thoughtful contributors. So what we'd like to do now, for maybe 7 or 8 minutes, is invite you in groups of 3, 4, or 5 to have a conversation amongst yourselves. And the two questions we'd like you to think about are, what do you long for in a good religion? What is it you're longing for? What would you love to see? What would you like to be part of in that kind of religion? And secondly, where do you see signs of that already existing? Where is it already present? What gives you hope that that kind of religion might emerge? So they're the two questions. Gather in groups of 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, just for 7 or 8 minutes, nothing too scary. And then I'll give you a notice about a minute from the end so that one of you might like to pop up to the microphone, which will be over there, and just share some wisdom, just briefly, of what you may have learned. And then we'll reflect on that. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. That was excellent. So if people from your group, someone from your group has some insight or some piece of wisdom and you'd like to share it with the panel, with everybody else, please come to the microphone on the left. Wander over and we're thinking, what do we long for in good religion? And where do we see signs of it?
We need less beliefs in our churches and more values, which is what I think Jesus preached. More values, less beliefs.
Thank you.
And the Unitarian Church and the Sunday Assembly would be examples of those.
We had less beliefs but more practices, life-giving practices. We also touched on the outside world. on female leadership and inter-spiritual practices, and on connecting across differences and valuing differences.
Thank you.
We talked about belonging, which needs openness, an invitation to build trust together, but not just being a member, connection and being known, being part of something bigger than ourselves, across peoples, species, places, but also time, being respectful of the wisdom of the past, but also aware of and intentional about how what we do will impact the children of the future.
Thank you.
We felt like a lot of it was quite simple, and the three things that we thought really worked were communities that were intergenerational, that it was free to turn up to, which is becoming increasingly rare, and that there was a network of them across the country. So you could go, if you were somewhere else in the country, you could turn up to a different one and still feel like you belonged. And the only two other examples we could come up with is Parkrun and the Labour Party. So if you have any other ones, we felt like they were places that people gather about around a strong belief and don't worry about the rest of things.
Thank you.
Hi. So we talked about community and being able to turn up as yourself, including your body, providing a sense of awe and wonder and the best of human experience. And examples of that brought a lot of them from the arts. And we also thought about the sort of balance between having ritual and some structure and organisation, but not having it top-led with somebody who was up there providing all the answers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We're a big group, so it's a long list. The kind of communal singing and music and the accessibility, particularly of evangelical music, the relationship with the unseen world, for real feeling when in ritual, to many different alternative and varied states of consciousness, from plant medicines to sex to dance to song, a sense of shamelessness, both within the religious experience, like not to be shamed by our religious institutions or our religious leaders, but also as religious people to not be shamed by the rest of the world as if there's something wrong with us. And also for the histories of those religious institutions not to persistently be shamed for the things they have gotten wrong, but for those to be accepted and understood as human foibles. For there to be kinder institutions that are not so harsh and not so like a gang that you have to belong to, and if you haven't followed the rules, then you don't belong. And also for institutions to have integrity, for there to be churches of nature, for there to be fresh, vital and enjoyable services in and with nature that are true gatherings of faith in nature, for there to be intergenerational relating and elders who can guide and uplift and help us to get in touch with our gifts, and also for these conversations about the new religion to not be led by middle class educated liberal elites, but instead for people to be listening to the people who are among us, for to be looking out to the people who are gathering around fires, gathering in kitchens, gathering in shop fronts, and already that this new religion is rising. And we do not need to be led by middle-class educated elites.
Thank you. Noted.
We talked about community as well, but thought that community needed to be grounded in something like God or spirit or something that's bigger or beyond us. And we wanted a religion where deeper connection is possible with that kind of basis, and participating in the Trinity, meaning God, community, relationship. And just at the end there, said about being in a space where people aren't their market value, but are just valued because they exist. Even if they're a tiny helpless baby who's come for baptism, they're part of something, even though they can't contribute to capitalism.
Thank you.
We talked about a longing for openness and for depth,
we resonated with the word awe that people on the panel had used. We talked a lot about silence, connection, community. So those are our longings, and to find a way of creating a safe space where, as a species, we don't have to kind of hum and look away because it's all too difficult. And in terms of where we found those already, and my new friend talked about his astronomy club, which just sounded a lovely space of awe and community. We talked about beer and hymns here. We talked about a both and space where it's possible to both despair and rejoice. And we talked about the still centre of a Quaker meeting.
Thank you. We talk quite locally. Get away from one-way communication. Secondly, try to create real communities. One example is 12-step groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, where there's real honesty and community and sharing. And another one was one of our in our group walks her dog, and she's actually part of a local dog walkers WhatsApp group, and who they share and support each other. It's very simple.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those really, really interesting contributions. I'm going to ask our panel now, yes, to reflect on those as we draw this session to a close.
David or Gail, do you have thoughts bubbling? I mean, maybe if I just jump in, one thing that I heard from a couple of people and it felt very strong was the importance of intergenerational community. And that was certainly something that I didn't know was missing from my life. I didn't know could be a thing until I found myself part of a congregation and suddenly had friends who were in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And it was a different kind of relationship that I hadn't really experienced. You know, having elders that cared about me, but in a way that was entirely different to people I'm related to. I just feel like, especially as people, when people don't live near their families, then access to elders is incredibly difficult, and kind of vice versa as well with so much loneliness. So I heard that very loudly, the importance of intergenerational community.
I have to say I'm sort of, my body's still vibrating from the intervention of the sister down here. And there's so many beautiful things said and I felt some real pain in that. And I don't mean, I'm not individualizing you with that. I'm feeling that for the collective. And I'm in some curiosity of like what was in there. And I, like, my body went into a separation for a moment and I'm sort of wanting, well, I'm just with that, really. I don't want to put words into it, but maybe there's a gratitude, but there's also just a hearing, even if I'm not sure quite what I heard. I think when there's those moments of like, that's what I'm being taught by my sister Skeena Rathore, who's a co-liberationist practitioner, a somatic practitioner, like, oh, okay, that was a moment, right? That was a moment. So I don't want to skip over that somehow, even though I don't really know quite what it was. And I do partly. Okay, anyway, thank you. My dad was a coal miner, by the way. I felt that defence, sorry. I felt this defensive bit. My dad was a coal miner, so I don't care.
The thing I'm speaking to, I felt quite triggered during this. And actually, like, I know at least two of you. Hi, Liz. Hi, Gail. And David, we've been in conversations before about different work to do together. And I've been in the world of, like, trying to create space for people to connect with the divine since I was, like, literally 14. I started doing it when I was doing my GCSEs. It matters to me. And also from a working class background. And I feel like I went through a treadmill, a rat race of middle classery in order to realize that that was not where it's at. And you hear these whispers as you're I'm just trying to find ways to bring people into God with some kind of integrity. That's all I'm trying to do. And you find, you hear whispers of like, oh, there's this like gathering over there, or these people are gathering over here, or if you can join that little club, that'll be cool. And that's how you're going to get the job done. And a few years ago, I actually, like, counter to like what I think a lot of people in this space are doing, I joined the Church of England as a way to actually be in connection with people who need God. I'm talking about people who need food banks, people who are in prison, people who are in the armed forces. And I think I've developed a deep distaste for the kind of idea of a religion that is purely celebratory and doesn't tend to the real suffering of people in this country. And I find the Church of England over and over again tends to the real suffering of people in this country. Sure, the services are off and the doctrine is really need a lot of updating, but they tend to the poor and the oppressed and the needy and the sick in a way that these elitist liberal narratives just do not. They do not even account for. And that is what I felt really triggered by that in this session. Not because I don't love you, who I know and enjoy you, David. I don't love you as much, but I know these two. Like. And I haven't met you, but nice to meet you. Like, but yeah, that's where that came from. So thanks for responding to that, Gail. I appreciate that.
It's nice to finally meet you too. Sorry. I'm thinking about what it is to hear different people dreaming. Dreaming beautiful visions and what you do with those. It's beautiful to hear beautiful visions. And then there's something horrifying to me about the possibility of a sort of Frankenstein's monster religion. I don't think anyone ever made a religion on purpose.
Oh, I think
it always happens in some sort of weird convulsion of happenings in the world and that kind of thing. There's something playful, I think, about the question and the premise of these discussions. What it is to hear these dreams, it has me thinking about something a writer called Theodore Adorno said once. He said, the only way to really think about the world is to imagine it as it would be if you woke up one day and the messianic dawn had occurred and there was everything just as it should be. You imagine that. We do it all the time. Now, when you do that, at once you have like the negative image of that and you see all the things that you don't want. You imagine everything you want. You see the shadow version of everything. You suddenly realize everything that irks you and everything that you want to fix. And this is just what we do. We all kind of think messianically on some kind of level. But then, says Theodore Adorno, once you've done that, you have to recognize that everything you see that's wrong with the world, because the world is somehow wounded and wrong, you're part of the world and you're part of the wrongness. And your vision of everything made whole is also part of... You can't rely on it to be right. You have to doubt your own vision of the way things should be. So you have this loss of confidence. So what do you do then? Then, says Theodore Adorno, then you just have to walk towards it anyway because it's the best thing you got. I think I have the desire to hold the beautiful dreams and visions that go around that are very much about how we want to live with one another on the ground and begin to live those questions out. I think that would be better than some... glued together religion that appeared out of a tent at Greenbelt Festival.
No. I would like to try that, though. You could be right, but I'd still like to try it.
Oh, yeah, cool.
I'm just reflecting on this. I think we're all kind of in the dark, and I love people reaching for something else. I love what you... I think you said earlier that you sort of implied that many of our religious institutions need to become the compost. Whereas a lot of time, a lot of religious professionals are engaged in keeping them in the air, whereas they need to go into the earth. And let's see what emerges.
Yeah, and I think the trusting that this is happening, we can observe it and we can be part of it, and we can feel where it's happening and where it's happening in us. But yeah, the more we try to design or Frankenstein, then it's sort of, I don't know what that looks like that doesn't end up being driven by individual egos rather than being in service to everything.
Good. Any other thoughts, anybody? Because we can, you know.
I at least the way I'm feeling it is that we're in a time of unknowing, you know, and it's a sort of increased time of wishing to know. I'm kind of like that Bacana two-loop model, you know, where something's on its way out and something may emerge. And Vanessa Mercado de Oliveira's book, Hospice in Modernity, part of what she talks about is not strangling the thing that wants to come through with our level of expectation and desperation, you know. So that's like, how are we, even in our own selves, letting something die and let go, and how are we letting something be born, and what does that need in us, this sort of space? And actually, to be honest, when you then, at the same time, when you're living in a system of capitalist extraction, I mean, it is a thing, in some ways, to partially answer your points, Sarah, but somebody talked about platform capitalism when XR took off the ground, and I could feel that, man, you can work that one. It's quite seductive, and how do we, you know, if you don't, hard to be in change-making spaces if you're not working and putting forwards ideas and having a book, etc. And at the same time, if you, yeah. Anyway, I'm not being very coherent, but I'm just saying that you're sort of trapped in something, at least to feel it and observe what's going off and where the attraction is to the seduction or the distraction, and like to be with the discomfort. I really recommend that book, Hospice in Modernity, much more eloquent than what I just said.
The other thing that's been, I think about a lot, but it's just, you know, thinking about it here, is how unhelpful it is to think of religion as something that's separate to culture. And I know that's sort of how it has been in this country for most people. But it feels like that in itself is part of the problem, that it's, you know, what if it's not something that happens in a funny building on a particular day of the week? What if it's in everything that we're doing together? And it's just a, you know, how humans are together in a way that's driven by connection and community and not by money and greed.
Yeah, what if we included everyone? Or aspired to include everyone rather than ruling people out because of their particular differences. Thank you very much, everybody, for taking part. Thank you to our panelists and to all of you for your wisdom. Who knows? Something's happening, something's being born, none of us know, but it's happening. Maybe it'll be after our time, but something's on the way.
Mm-hmm. And so as you go into your evenings and the weekend ahead and the days and weeks beyond, you might keep paying attention to where the religion of the future is already here, or the culture of the future, where it is alive, where you are already embodying it, and where it's calling for your help, where you see things that are the opposite of religion that you long for or are getting in the way, that you might trust that dead things naturally decay and turn your attention to what is alive and what is full of love. As Gail said, we can learn from the land, and as David said, we can turn to the joy of creaturely awe. And as Brian said, if religion is a celebration of love, then we should probably all be doing more of it. So thank you all for being part of this exploration. Don't forget to add your thoughts to the board over there over the course of the weekend. Invite others to as well. And as you go into your evening, don't forget to celebrate love. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.